Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. The nominating conventions are over, the balloons are being popped and dumpsters filled with confetti. We'll recap the conventions from a Northwest perspective this morning. We have reports from Northwest News correspondent Steve Jackson and Austin Jenkins. In the second half, we'll hike Washington's tallest volcano with Courtney Flatt. Don't gear up. You can do this hike in your footsies. You're listening to The Bridge for the week of July 28th. Last week at the Republican National Convention, there was talk of turning over some federal lands to state control. One bill pending in Congress is proposing to let local new law enforcement replace federal law enforcement agencies. Steve Jackson has more.
This spring in the U.S. House, H.R. 4751 was introduced, which would terminate the law enforcement functions of the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. The bill was filed just a few weeks after the armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. Bill co-sponsor, Republican Congressman Dan Newhouse of Washington State, says the plan calls for those federal law enforcers to be replaced by local ones like county sheriffs.
Most of the time, in most instances around the country, county sheriff's departments are, they're accountable to local people. The county sheriff is elected by the citizens of the county. There's a level of trust in local law enforcement.
Newhouse says the measure was a reaction to calls from local constituents complaining about interactions with federal law enforcement agencies. The proposal calls for block grants to be provided to local law enforcement agencies to be able to add additional personnel to patrol federal lands. For some local law enforcement, that could add hundreds of square miles of federal forest or BLM lands to their jurisdiction. One example would be the Ferry County Sheriff's Office in Northeast Washington. Sheriff Ray McCumber says incidents like the Malheur occupation and the Bundy Ranch standoff in Nevada may have been solved earlier had local sheriffs been in control rather than the feds.
They have not done a lot to inspire trust in the people that they serve, and they need to remember that they serve the people just like I do, and it's part of my responsibility to hold them accountable within Ferry County. That's why the law and the hierarchy of authority is set up the way that it is so that the people locally have that authority through their sheriff.
Maycomber believes with federal funding, his office could hire two deputies to handle the job of patrolling the huge Colville National Forest in his county's boundaries, but he's not so sure about being responsible for certain types of federal rules regarding forest use, like unauthorized timber harvest.
When it comes to those laws, or those rules, I guess, that the Forest Service put out, enforcement becomes tricky because the authority that's granted to me is granted by the state of Washington. And I don't know if the county would need to pass ordinances that mirror certain rules, or if we could, there would be room within us passing ordinances to process on the civil or criminal side that met with the Forest Service's expectations.
The proposed legislation is not finding much support from those who are currently in charge of BLM and Forest Service law enforcement. Nate Katura is president of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, who says he believes any local law enforcement would find themselves overwhelmed and unprepared for the type of issues that they would have to deal with,
compared to the federal law enforcement agents currently serving in those positions.
They deal with archaeological resources, timber theft. They deal with catastrophic wildfire investigations and international drug trafficking. So these agents have the training, they're equipped, and they have the knowledge to work these type of investigations. I doubt very much that a local sheriff, though, are well-trained themselves. They don't have the expertise.
Katura says the bill's prime sponsor, Representative Jason Chabots of Utah, is responding to efforts by the Western States Sheriffs Association, which does not recognize the authority of federal law enforcement on lands inside their state. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
Republican and Democratic Party platforms this year are addressing trade, gun violence, and even pornography as a national health hazard. What the parties aren't addressing is one of the country's biggest killers, traffic accidents. Last year, more than 38,000 people were killed and 4.4 million seriously injured in traffic accidents, according to the National Safety Council. Founder of the news site Consumer Affairs, Jim Hood, says people in the U.S. die from gun violence and in cars at about equal rates each year. However, one of those issues received much more attention from politicians.
There's a lot of commotion and political turmoil and heated debate over the gun death situation, but really not much over traffic deaths.
The National Safety Council's report shows Oregon saw the biggest jump in traffic fatalities of any state last year, increasing by 27%. Nationwide, deaths increased by 8%, making it the deadliest year on the road since 2008. Hood says the interests of the auto industry could account for some political apathy on the issue. The campaign finance tracking site Open Secrets notes that candidates from both parties have received $15 million from the auto industry over the past year. That's $2 million more than the party received from gun rights groups, according to the site. Hood says one way to combat some of the auto industry's influence could be through public awareness campaigns. Among the hundreds of delegates and lobbyists at the DNC is a 16-member caucus of Northwest tribes. They've made the journey back east to shine a little light on Native American priorities in the Northwest. Julie Johnson, a member of the Lummi tribe in western Washington, is the caucus chair. She says it will be a busy time for the caucus.
There's just so many issues. There's fishing issues, treaty rights, sovereignty issues.
The group began to organize a year ago. They decided to focus on four key areas: health, education, economic development, and natural resources. Johnson says the Northwest Native Caucus condensed that work into a handout for meetings and networking at the convention.
I strongly believe that Native people have to be at the table on voting, for what our priorities are.
The national platform developed this week in Philadelphia will stand as the party's official platform for the next 4 years.
I do believe you've laid a curse on North America, a curse that we here now rehearse in Philadelphia. A second flood, a simple famine, plagues of locusts everywhere, or a cataclysmic earthquake, I'd accept with some despair. But no, you sent us Congress. Good God, sir, was that fair? I say this with humility.
Even though Oregon voters legalized recreational marijuana in 2014, you can't legally buy the stuff in more than 100 Oregon communities. That's because some city and county governments have banned recreational marijuana businesses. Voters in nearly half of those places will have the chance to overturn those bans this November. Correspondent Chris Lehman explains.
Sales are brisk here at Going Green in Albany, Oregon. Going Green is a medical marijuana dispensary. You have to have an Oregon medical marijuana card to shop here. And owner Sean Amon says while business is good, a lot of people who walk in the door leave empty-handed.
We have 10 to 12 people a day come in to ask to purchase recreational, and we have to send them to either Corvallis, Salem, or Springfield.
As if on cue, a potential customer walks in the door and asks to buy some marijuana, but he's from out of state and doesn't have the necessary paperwork. So the man pulls out his phone and looks up directions to Corvallis. Amon says it's getting to the point where he doesn't even want to work at the front desk.
As a business owner, it feels incredibly frustrating to have to send customers down the street.
It's only about 12 miles to Corvallis, where a half dozen dispensaries will gladly sell pot to recreational users. But in Albany, only medical sales are allowed. That's because the city council banned recreational marijuana businesses last fall. People can still grow and use pot in their homes. The ban was put in place despite the fact that a majority of the city's voters approved the 2014 statewide ballot measure to legalize pot, though truth be told, it was close. In a city of 50,000 people, the margin was fewer than 400 votes.
For a community our size, that's not very many people. So I knew our community was very divided on the issue.
That's Albany Mayor Sharon Canopa. She supports the council's ban on recreational marijuana sales. The ban is in effect until the November election, when voters will either extend it indefinitely or overturn it. Canopa says it was reasonable to take a one-year time out to let people in Albany see how recreational marijuana plays out in other Oregon cities. But she says, what's the big deal if Albany isn't a place where you can buy recreational pot?
Every community doesn't have to have every product that is sold. We don't have every business. We don't have an IKEA in Albany. You know, should we? Because they, you know, Portland has it. Should we have it?
Not everyone in City Hall thinks the ban is a good idea. Ray Kobzinski was one of two city councilors to vote against it.
We're driving business away and the tax revenue that's potentially available from it.
A tenth of the state sales tax on recreational marijuana is being divvied up among Oregon cities, but only to cities that allow recreational sales. The money has to be used for law enforcement. But Oregon also allows cities and counties to locally tax marijuana sales, up to 3%. And here's an interesting twist. At the same time that Albany's city council will ask voters if they want to continue to ban the sale of recreational marijuana, they'll also ask voters whether they want to tax it. To Going Green owner Sean Amon, it's another slap in the face.
Now that they feel like they could might lose the fight, we want to make sure we get our 3%. Can we get our money? We need our money. And the audacity of that is almost comical.
But for Amon and Albany's other medical dispensary owners, the bigger question this fall is whether the city's voters will vote for the second time in 2 years to legalize the sale of recreational marijuana. I'm Chris Lehman in Albany, Oregon.
California, Oregon, and Washington states have important goals for increasing the number of non-polluting vehicles on the road. To achieve those goals, we all need to buy electric cars at a higher rate than we're seeing now. Hundreds of electric car enthusiasts and policymakers gathered in Portland last week to weigh on how to spur consumer demand. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has the story.
Eavesdrop with me for a moment on a focus group in Portland. A consumer research company has gathered a cross-section of local drivers to gauge their interest in going electric.
Electric vehicles, first thing that comes to mind?
Probably expensive.
Expensive, okay. Quanta?
Gas saver,
okay. David?
Too small.
All right. Doug, what about you, electric vehicle?
They're kind of a punchline, aren't they?
Many of the participants had a hard time naming even one electric car model. The majority tell moderator John Horvick they would not consider a plug-in car for their next vehicle purchase.
You know, my family's all in Sacramento, so that would be stopping 6 times, 20 minutes. That's an hour of just waiting to charge to get down there. So
the biggest thing is that replacement battery. I've heard so much bad stuff about that, you know. That's a factor.
The attendees at an electric vehicle conference watched this unfold live via video feed to an auditorium big screen. It's a reality check about how little the average car shopper knows about driving electric, says advocate Jeff Allen.
That's a little bit depressing after 5 years of the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt and dozens of other models available, that we're still there.
Allen directs the Electric Vehicle Trade Association, Drive Oregon. His nonprofit is prioritizing consumer awareness activities to help sell electric cars.
Just doing ride and drive to get people exposed to the cars. There haven't been nearly enough of those with new electric cars, but there have been almost none of them with used electric cars.
And he thinks that could make a difference. Allen says a lot of electric cars are coming off leases this year and going on the used car market at affordable prices. Mass market plug-in cars first appeared in Northwest dealerships in late 2010. Half a decade later, sales of fully electric and plug-in electric hybrid cars account for less than 2% of all new car sales in Oregon and Washington, and virtually none in Idaho. Tonya Buell with the Washington State Department of Transportation says it's still early in the game.
So the state of Washington has a goal of 50,000 electric vehicles on our roads by 2020, and we're well on our way to reaching that. Right now we have more than 16,000 electric vehicles registered in the state of Washington.
Buell says it was helpful that the Washington legislature earlier this year expanded the range of plug-in models that qualify for a sales tax break. In Portland this past week, major automakers gave a pre-release look at some new battery-powered models. Those include a plug-in hybrid minivan from Chrysler, a longer-range upscale plug-in hybrid Prius from Toyota, and the fully electric Chevy Bolt, a compact advertised to have a 200-mile range. Nissan North America's Director of Government Affairs is Tracy Woodard. She says one thing that should help sales is that the plug-in cars are getting cheaper.
Battery costs are coming down and different models are coming out. I think right now incentives still do matter. We still have the federal tax credit. You've got a state incentive in a lot of these states. I think that definitely helps. Mm-hmm. I think small things like signage for charging infrastructure would go a long way.
Lawmakers in Oregon and California, but not in Washington state, have given environmental regulators the authority to fine automakers who fall short of a complicated zero-emissions vehicle sales threshold. Automakers are meeting the current targets, but the mandate ramps up to a much higher sales volume over the coming decade. I'm Tom Bonsi in Portland.
Similar to Wednesday's focus group, an analysis of consumer attitudes by researchers from the University of California, Davis, published earlier this year, highlighted lack of awareness as the leading barrier to wider adoption of electric vehicles. That reason was accompanied by a host of secondary concerns and questions that cumulatively led prospective car buyers to pass over plug-in models. Among other barriers were range, cost, and the availability of charging stations. Buell said plug-in vehicle infrastructure is getting attention in Washington state. She said an increase in the annual EV registration fee will fund grants to organizations to subsidize new charging station installations along major roadways. At the beginning of July, the cost to renew license tabs for an electric car in the Evergreen state went from $100 to $150. A pending multi-billion-dollar national settlement with Volkswagen to make restitution for its cheating on emission controls may include significant set-asides to promote transportation electrification and charging station deployments. A program rolling out next year will install electric car chargers in Seattle homes and parts of the city. Seattle City Light discussed the plan during a Portland conference attended by almost 400 electric car industry leaders. The utility will put chargers in several hundred homes and install 20 in the city that can power some vehicles in 30 minutes. Electric cars and plug-in hybrids accounted for 1% of the country's auto sales as of June. Experts say annual sales could reach 15% by 2025. A study found $300 million in electricity sales was possible if a quarter of vehicles on the road were electric by 2035. Seattle City Light Energy Planning Supervisor Brendan O'Donnell said the utility can handle that demand. You're listening to The Bridge. What say we leave the sweep up of these cluttered and often confusing conventions and get out of our cars, electric or otherwise, for at least a little while? Mount Adams rises above the horizon as Washington's second tallest volcano, 12,276 feet. It's a peak that Northwest Public Radio's Courtney Flatt has been dreaming of reaching for years. She's convinced two friends to climb to the summit with her this summer. and she sent us this audio postcard.
Hi, I'm Sarah Schilling.
My name is Eddie Goss.
And I'm Courtney Flatt. And this is our trip up Mount Adams. This is the first mountain summit for me and Sarah, but Eddie's a little bit more experienced. He made it up Mount Hood about a month ago. So we had some questions.
What do you like about climbing mountains?
You know what? Going up there, you're always like, what am I doing this for? And then you get to the top and you sit down. Nothing else there but you, and that's what makes life worth living. Moments like that.
So we packed up and began our long 6-mile slog to the summit. There were lupins blossoming all around, and it was just a beautiful, clear day.
It really is stunningly beautiful out here. The sky is so crazy blue. I feel like doing a happy dance.
About a mile and a half in, we made it to the snow, strapped on our crampons, and started to climb up a hilly ridge. It's no longer a happy dance. We're all pretty tired. We definitely didn't eat enough food today. So we set up camp, a little short of our goal for the first day.
It's getting late.
Yeah.
Let's have a meal while there's still light. It's going to be a long slog tomorrow.
That night was bitterly cold.
I feel like it's the coldest I've ever been in my life.
Definitely. And now we're getting up. Bit of a late start. We slept in. It's about 5 o'clock, but we're going to head for the summit. All right.
Woohoo!
To get to the summit, first you have to make it up what's called Piker's Peak. We couldn't even see the real top of Adams. Piker's Peak is a false summit, and it's tough. You gain about 2,000 feet in elevation. Our mantra became 1 foot in front of the other. So these dudes that just passed us told us we're at the hardest part. So that's very exciting. And then step by step, we were almost there. We're just a few feet away from the summit, and I think it's going to be really windy up there, so I'm just going to record this now, but I think we made it. The view is amazing, and I think from the very top we're going to be able to see Rainier. So you can see Hood, St. Helens. Reaching the top was exhilarating. I was so tired. Everything hurt, but I was really happy. And then it was time to head down. Maybe my favorite part of the whole day. So we glissaded down the mountain. It's like sliding down a luge on your butt and you use your ice axe as a brake. Totally crazy. Several miles of hiking later, and we'd made it back to the car. Driving back into town, we reflected on the trip.
First half of the fall summit, I was like, I can do this, this is not so bad. Mm-hmm. Second half was a nightmare.
There was a fall summit to the fall summit.
And then we were at the top, and it was like, well, you can see it.
Yeah.
You can't turn around now.
We were all glad we kept going.
And it was neat to think about just being another one in a long line of people to make it there, to see how beautiful it was and to have done something like that.
As Eddie said, moments like that are what make life worth living. Courtney Flatt, Northwest Public Radio, Mount Adams.
Home again. Thank you, Courtney. And thank you for listening. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org, and you can like us on Facebook. This is Kate Brister. We'll see you next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.